Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. If you listen to this show on any kind of regular basis, you know that we cover a lot of ground. Ralph Nader a few weeks ago on solutions to America's political and economic challenges, then Lester Brown on global food scarcity. 2 weeks ago, we talked about nuclear power in San Diego and renewable energy in Germany, and last week about the power of story and narrative. Today, we're going to talk about the very nature of reality in the universe. My guest, Howard Bloom, has written a number of books on some of our biggest questions, and his latest is The God Problem, How a Godless Cosmos Creates. Howard Bloom has been called, quote, next in a lineage of seminal thinkers that includes Newton, Darwin, Einstein, and Freud by Britain's Channel 4 TV, the next Stephen Hawking by Gear Magazine. His previous books include The Lucifer Principle, A Scientific Expedition into the Forces of History, Global Brain, The Evolution of Mass Mind from the Big Bang to the 21st Century, and The Genius of the Beast, A Radical Revision of Capitalism. Heavy stuff, sure, but his biography is a lot quirkier than that list might suggest. From 68 to 88, Bloom made his mark in the music business, founding and running its biggest PR firm, working with Michael Jackson, Prince, Bob Marley, Bette Midler, Queen, Simon and Garfunkel, Peter Gabriel, Grandmaster Flash, and the Furious Five, among many others. He helped launch Farm Aid and Amnesty International's American presence. He worked with the United Negro College Fund, and he put together the first public service radio campaign for solar power. Bloom launched a successful Kickstarter campaign to raise money for PR for the new book, The God Problem, because he says changing a paradigm doesn't just happen. A lot of people have given glowing blurbs to this new book, but let me read from one by Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Nickel and Dimed and a frequent guest on Pacifica. Quote, if Howard Bloom is only 10% right, we'll have to drastically revise our notions of the universe. There's no mysticism in the God problem. No God, no religion, no incommunicable spiritual insights, just the contagious joy of a great mind set loose on the biggest intellectual puzzles humans have ever faced. And Ehrenreich says, whether you're a scientist or a hyper-curious layperson, Bloom's argument will rock your world. So, settle down, listen up, and let's go for a ride into the biggest questions of all. How did anything happen? How did anything come into existence? And how can we see into those questions? Here on Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Welcome, Howard Bloom, to Free Forum.
Terrence, thanks very much.
Okay. Really good to have you with us. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. And anyone who picks up this book will see that you're willing to interweave your personal story into these sorts of questions and so on. So tell us a bit, and feel free to wind your way in this one. Tell us a bit about your path to the work that you're doing today, and feel free to mention mentors or turning points or moments of decision.
Well, the really big turning point came when I was 10 years old. I was a kid that nobody wanted. My parents had no time for me. Other kids my age had absolutely no interest. Remember, I was a dweeb. I was a nerd. I was not a socially adept kid. And so presumably they had good reason not to want to have anything to do with me. Terrence, I couldn't throw a baseball, I couldn't catch a baseball, and I couldn't comprehend what was interesting about a baseball game. So at any rate, there I am very much alone in my hometown of Buffalo, New York, and it's Saturday afternoon, it's 3 o'clock. I'm sure it's sunny outdoors, but my parents always kept the drapes to our big living room clothes, these big velvet drapes, and I'm sitting there with a book in my hand that I've never seen before in my life and never will see again. And I open the thing up, and it tells me the first two rules of science. And with those rules, it utterly galvanizes me. Rule number one, it says, is the truth at any price, including the price of your life. If you have to go down in flames and die for your truth, then so be it. And it tells the tale of Galileo. And it says that he would have been willing to be burned at the stake, like Giordano Bruno, in order to maintain his truth that the earth went around the sun. Now, fortunately, it tells the tale in this way because it turns out this story is wrong. In fact, the Pope was a good friend of Galileo's. In fact, Galileo cut a deal. In fact, Galileo did give up his truth, said that everything he'd written had been wrong, and gave it up in exchange for house arrest. But that's not what I needed to hear at the age of 10. At the age of 10, I needed to hear a tale of pure heroism. And that's what the book gave me. Point number two, it said, the second rule of science is look at things right under your nose as if you've never seen them before, and then proceed from there. And it gave another only partial story. It gave the story of Anton von Leeuwenhoek, who had invented the microscope and then had looked down into a fluid and had seen what he called animalcules, tiny little self-propelled animals using whips as propellers. And again, it told me only part of the story. But what it didn't tell me was that what von Leeuwenhoek had been looking at was human sperm. Now, if you're Anton von Leeuwenhoek, a draper in Holland, and you've just invented this microscope, where do you get fresh human sperm? Well, that's a question we won't directly go into, but all I can tell you is it takes even more guts than the story was willing to tell me, because to masturbate and then send the results to the Royal Society in England and base your scientific career on it, that takes guts.
Yeah.
That does take courage. One way or the other, it gave me the tales of these two people, Galileo and Anton von Leeuwenhoek, who I could join up with and who couldn't reject me. Now, there was a very simple reason why they couldn't reject me. They were dead. They had no choice in the matter. So I basically joined on to this wild thing called science and was totally galvanized by it and became interested in microbiology and theoretical physics, and that's how this whole adventure began.
Now that's the beginning, but as we know, there were twists and turns. And one thing I was hearing there was that, of course, you could join their team and they couldn't say no.
Yes, exactly. Well, there was a big twist, and the big twist came when I was 12 years old, and my bar mitzvah was coming up, and this was going to be the very first time that I was ever going to be invited to a party in Buffalo, New York. It was going to be a party my dad was going to throw, and the center of attention was going to be me. And plus, I was going to get presents, another thing. I mean, who can resist presents? So I had read the arguments of Bertrand Russell. I mean, what happened to me after the age of 10 was that I started reading books. And I started reading two books a day. I read one book a day under the desk at school, and I read another book a day when I got home. And they were all books, either they were science fiction or they were about science. They were straight up adult science. And by the time I got to the age of 12, I had read an awful lot of books. And one of them was Bertrand Russell's arguments against God, and it made absolute sense to me. Bertrand Russell said, if this universe is so complex that it needs a creator to design it, and then what created this universe must be even more complex. And if God is the creator, God's got to be more complex, and then the question remains, who in the world created God? It's what we call these days an infinite regress. And that was it. No need, I mean, if you accept that argument, God is a ridiculous idea. But I had one problem with acknowledging that God was a ridiculous idea and that I was a stone-cold atheist and that the first two rules of science were, in fact, my religion.
And that was your bar mitzvah.
Yes. If I admitted that to myself, there goes the bar mitzvah, there goes the party, there go the presents. So I didn't admit it to myself until the bar mitzvah was over. And then something else happened. My bar mitzvah was at the very end of June, only 2 months later in September, the high holidays, the most important holidays in the Jewish calendar show up. My parents didn't bother to go to synagogue during the rest of the year, but they took the high holidays very seriously. So they dressed me up in a suit and tried to drag me to the temple. And as I was holding on to the door frame of our blue Fraser automobile, and my parents were holding on to my ankles, literally trying to drag me to the synagogue while I was refusing to go, something hit me. every tribe I'd ever read about in the world believed in gods, including, of course, my parents. And if my parents were this passionate about gods, and if other peoples in the world were this passionate about their gods, and if there were no gods in the heavens and there were no gods under the earth, then where in the world were these ubiquitous gods? They were in the hearts and minds of human beings. They were in somewhere deep within the human experience. And I suddenly realized that my job was not task number two of science in the sense of looking at what's under my nose. It was the job of looking at what's behind my nose. What were these gods? Where did they come from? And more important, if there were no gods, how in the world did this incredibly complex cosmos, complete with blue Fraser automobiles, socks, suits, synagogues, and the elm trees of Richmond Avenue, where the synagogue was, how did all of these astonishing things come to be? And that turned out to be the God question.
Very good. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Howard Bloom. He's the author of The God Problem, How a Godless Cosmos Creates, along with a number of other books. You can learn more at howardbloombooks.com. And it's important that you go Howard Bloom Books. You just go howardbloom.com and you find someone who's a realtor and got that website before you did.
Actually, the real site is howardbloom.net.
Oh, okay. Now, there were other twists, though, Howard Bloom. How did you end up in the music business? How, why, and then how did you end up out of the music business?
Well, again, if you become fascinated, if you think that one of your missions in science is to come to understand where the gods are, then you're up against a really big problem. The gods, at the age of 14... just after this whole thing with the bar mitzvah and finally being able to confess that I was an atheist, I heard about this book called The Varieties of the Religious Experience by William James. Now, there was no Amazon in those days, and it was devilishly difficult to get some books, including this one in Buffalo, New York, but I finally tracked it down. And it was as if William James, in 1905, had written this book specifically to me, and he had taken five extraordinary religious experiences, just amazing experiences, ecstatic experiences, experiences that go far outside the nature of normal. And he'd laid them out as if he were laying them out on a laboratory table. And it felt to me as if what he was saying was this: look, kid, it's 1905. I really don't have any excuse for putting these five experiences into a book and calling it science, except for the fact that I'm regarded as the epitome of psychological science in my day. What I'm really doing here is laying these samples of human experience out in front of you so that you, 50 years later, with your tools, can look at these things and possibly explain what I, in my time, was not able to explain. So understanding the ecstatic experience from its core, by both experiencing it and by using the tools of my microbiology and theoretical physics to understand it, that became a very, very important mission for me. Plus, a strange thing had happened the year I was born, the Holocaust. And my childhood was dominated by the Holocaust. And one of the things that I became very aware of very fast is that a guy named Adolf Hitler had been an absolute artist in working with these irrational aspects of the human spirit that are captured in those five varieties of the religious experience that William James had been talking about. He had been a master at creating the ecstatic experience, the experience of standing outside of and above yourself and becoming a part of something much, much bigger than yourself. The epitome of that for Hitler had been the organization of the Torchlight Parade, which he didn't do by himself. He organized it with Albert Speer, who was an incredible art director. And if you had been in the audience for one of those Torchlight Parades, you felt exalted high above yourself. You felt that you became one of something so much larger than yourself that it utterly transformed your life. You felt a part of Ein Volk, Ein Reich, Ein Führer. One people, one state, one leader. And I wanted to know how in the world Hitler had pulled this off, because it became very obvious to me that we were talking about more than just personal religious experience. when we were talking about where the gods are inside of ourselves. We were talking about the very forces of history. And when I graduated from, you know, I eventually dropped out of school for 3 years and accidentally helped start a movement that later gained a name, the hippie movement, and rode the rails and hitchhiked and all kinds of things, and that's another story for another time.
Right.
But when I went back to school, I got out magna cum laude, Phi Beta Kappa, and I had fellowships from four different grad schools. And it was they were fellowships in something that didn't have a name yet. It would later be called neurobiology. Then it was called physiological psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized something. I felt as if I was on a train to an Auschwitz of the mind. Here I was fascinated by ecstatic human experience and how it's used in mass, how massive amounts of it, how mass experience, how mass emotional experience is used to recreate history, to change the direction of history. And there was no way I was going to find that out going to grad school and learning to give paper and pencil tests to 22 college students in exchange for their psychology credit. So I didn't know how to get out of this. I did not know how to get into what really interested me and how to keep from going into something so sterile that I would never be able to find out the things that I was really curious about. And then an opportunity hit. I was kidnapped by the poet in residence at NYU to edit the literary magazine. I hated literary magazines. I turned it into an experimental graphics and literary magazine. I assembled a whole bunch of artists to pull this off. And I walked into the apartment of one of the artists at the beginning of the summer before I was supposed to go off to Columbia to grad school. And he was on the floor, his wife was on the floor, their baby was on the floor, and they were all crying, and there was no furniture in the room. And I asked what the matter was, and it turned out they were about to be thrown out of their apartment, their electricity was about to be turned off, and the phone was about to be turned off. They didn't have any money. And I thought, well, this artist is brilliant. If I take his catalog out, if I just take his portfolio out for 2 weeks, I'll get him jobs, and then he can pay his rent. So I started to take his portfolio out and the portfolio of some of the other artists. We organized ourselves as an art studio. We called ourselves Cloud Studio and figured by the end of the summer everything would be fine. I'd go off to Columbia. But no, at the end of the summer, I got New York Magazine interested in doing a story on these artists, but I hadn't sold anything. And my wife was tired of having student husbands. Her previous husband had also been a student. So between all of these pressures and the fact that I don't like to leave a job undone, this was my opportunity to jump the tracks of academia and use the art studio as a periscope position to find my way into those mass emotional phenomena where the gods are. And that led to my getting into rock and roll.
Fabulous. I'm Terrence McNally. That's Howard Bloom. As you can hear, among other things, he is the author of The God Problem, How a Godless Cosmos Creates, and you can learn more at howardbloombooks.com or howardbloom.net, B-L-O-O-M. You know, one thing that I hear in that also is that Hitler claims that a absolutely significant event in transforming him from the suffering artist he was to the Führer he became was Wagner's opera.
And, makes absolute sense because I'm one day living on the Lower East Side with the woman who was about to become my wife, living in a neighborhood or on a block where somebody was shot every week and you couldn't, your parents couldn't buy you a new typewriter for school because if they did buy it for you within 2 weeks, it would be stolen. A very, very bad neighborhood, and trying to make her apartment livable for this woman who would become my wife. It was during the WBAI Pacifica Station day of the year when they play nothing but Wagner. And here I was moving a refrigerator all by myself in order to put a new floor into the kitchen. And boy, did I feel exalted by what's-his-name's theme, you know, the big hero, the guy who saves the girl. At any rate, whatever his name is, of the Ring Cycle. But once again, its heroic themes definitely gave you a sense of being one with something far, far bigger than yourself.
Right. So what I'm saying is, yeah, Hitler is inspired by music and mass audience experiences to create his experience. You're inspired by Hitler to then go into music.
Yes, exactly. And music turned out to be exactly where I needed to be. I mean, what later happened was 3 years later, the studio was one of the most successful avant-garde commercial art studios on the East Coast. I knew that I needed this as a periscope position. I needed to look around and find my way into what really interested me. I knew nothing about popular music, not a thing. I had grown up on Rachmaninoff, Beethoven, Bartok, Stravinsky, people like that. Certainly not on rock and roll, but I loved it when I heard it. I did love rock and roll. And I'd had another formative experience when I was 12 years old. I didn't realize it, but people in my school never made eye contact with me. My classmates, my teachers, nobody ever made eye contact with me. Well, one day, a girl moved her eyes in my direction and actually pinned them on me, which was startling. It had never happened before. And she did something even worse. She opened her mouth and spoke to me, which just didn't happen. And she said, "I told my mother you understand the theory of relativity." Okay, well, I'm 12 years old, and I haven't got baseball going for me, and I haven't got social popularity going for me. The only thing I've got going for me is my reputation for having a brain. They used to call me the sickly scientist. So I didn't dare confess that I didn't know the theory of relativity. I jumped on my bicycle as soon as school was out and pedaled to the local library, where the librarians knew me better than my mother did, and said, "Give me everything you've got on Einstein." And they gave me a great big fat book and a little skinny book. And I had learned by then that if you read books that are incomprehensible to you, even if you don't think you understand a word, by the time you get to the end, you understand more than you think. So I started with a great big fat book, which was all equations and only about one sentence of English on each page. And I stuck with it diligently from 4 o'clock in the afternoon until 8 o'clock at night. But I was only up to page 50, and then I realized my mother's going to put me to bed in 2 hours, and I still don't understand the theory of relativity, and I dare not be humiliated tomorrow at school. So I turned to the little skinny book, which Albert Einstein had written all by himself, and just like that experience with William James, it was as if when I started to read the introduction, Albert Einstein had reached out through the pages of the book, grabbed me by the lapels, put his nose to mine, and said, "Kid, listen up." And he said, "If you want to be a genius, it's not enough to come up with a theory that only 7 men in the world can understand," his reputation at the time. "You have to be able to come up with a theory only 7 men can understand. Then you have to be able to express it so clearly that anyone with a high school education and a reasonable degree of intelligence can understand it." So Einstein, when I was 12 years old, had given me marching orders. He had told me that if you really want to be a scientific thinker, you have to become a really, really good writer. So when I had the art studio, I started writing for magazines. And I started writing. I'd get up in the morning at 6 o'clock. I'd go directly to the typewriter. I would write until 8 o'clock. Then I would go to the art studio. Then I'd come home at night and sit there with a pot of coffee and work until 11 o'clock. And it was getting tiresome. And my artists were getting very well set up in life. And one day at a conference on, of all things, clairvoyance and parapsychology, somebody walked up to me and said, "How would you like to edit a magazine?" And I thought, wow, if I edited a magazine, I could do what Albert Einstein told me to do. I could work on writing, understandably, during my waking hours.
That's right, and be paid for it.
Yes. So I didn't even ask what the magazine was about. Earlier in my career, during a summer vacation, I had gotten a writing job, and I had been given the job of writing for the Boy Scouts of America. Well, Terrence, I'd been thrown out of the Boy Scouts for incompetence at Morse code when I was 11. And it didn't matter. I still wrote their books on stalking and tracking, and I wrote them with all my heart and soul and camouflage and on how to organize a Boy Scout troop from nothing. And I wrote these with all my heart and soul so that a kid in the forest could walk right up to a bunny rabbit, or creep right up to a bunny rabbit, and rub its nose with his nose before the rabbit even realized there was a human there. So I figured it doesn't matter what the subject is. If I'm committed to my audience and I want to do the best for them, I can write for them. And when I walked into the interview, it turned out to be a magazine about rock and roll.
Which one was it?
It was called Circus. Mm-hmm. It was a monthly magazine, and in the course of the next 2 years, I used every technique I'd ever learned from Martin Gardner's mathematical games section of the Scientific American to understand my audience, to understand it both in terms of numbers, but most important, to understand it in terms of my own heart, to understand it in terms of my own empathic abilities to be my audience. And the result was that we increased sales 211%, and Rolling Stone, one of Rolling Stone's founding editors, Chet Flippo, wrote a thesis on the history of rock and roll journalism and sent me over 6 pages by messenger, and I couldn't figure out why. And I read about this person sitting in a windowless room, a converted closet, doing these miracles. And at the end, it said, and this guy created an entirely new magazine genre, the heavy metal magazine, and it was me.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so I am the person, a Bartok and Stravinsky fan,
right,
is the guy responsible for bringing you the heavy metal magazine.
Okay, that's Howard Bloom. We're talking about his life right now, but it leads into the book he's just written, The God Problem, How a Godless Cosmos Creates. Okay, so then you spend a bunch of years in the music business, which, if I'm not mistaken, is you're doing your work, you're producing results, but for you, this is still scientific observation, yes or no?
It's field work. It's the most incredible form of field work I could possibly imagine. It's the voyage of the Beagle and then more. Because the voyage of the Beagle, when Darwin did it, there was a ritual established of a voyage of discovery. There was another ritual of taking something called a naturalist, which was a ritualized position on a voyage of discovery. The whole thing was something that was done normally in society. But jumping into popular culture and ending up working with some of the biggest rock and rollers in the world is not something that's been ritualized. It's not normal within science. And yet it's the kind of adventure that science really demands if we're going to understand some of the biggest mysteries on the planet.
I'm Terrence McNally, and this is Howard Bloom. I'm talking to his newest book is The God Problem. At some point, you have a 15-year illness.
Oh, God, yes. So so one day, Seymour Stein, who will later become known as the founder of Sire Records, the man who signed Madonna.
Well, let me tell you, Howard, he also signed Julie Brown.
Ah, yes, Earth Girls Are Easy, your old project.
Exactly, and the songs that, you know, how Homecoming Queen's Got a Gun, Earth Girls Are Easy, I Like 'Em Big and Stupid. Seymour was the guy who saw enough in those to say, Julie should be on Warner Brothers Records, and then we got the deal with Warner Brothers Films to make the film, et cetera, et cetera. So,
well, Seymour became a mentor of mine while I was in the magazine business, and Seymour one day walked into my office at ABC Records, where he had gotten me a job creating an artist development and public relations department for Gulf and Western's 14 record companies. At any rate, he said, "Schmuck, if you're so smart, why don't you have your own company?" And I started my own company, and we worked with Prince, Michael Jackson, Bob Marley, Bette Midler, AC/DC, Aerosmith, Kiss, Queen, Run-DMC, Billy Joel, Billy Idol, Paul Simon, Peter Gabriel, David Byrne, Run-DMC, etc. It was an amazing adventure, and it has depths that are beyond what you can get out of listening to just a list like this.
Right.
Because it's a matter of finding forms of music that are becoming anthems for a subculture that doesn't yet recognize its own existence. And then using a superstar or a person who's going to become a superstar and the music to give that subculture a sense of identity. That, it turns out, is a large part of what music is all about. And I was doing this very successfully for 17 years. In 1981, I went back to my science, but in my spare time, and I started to do the research for what would be my first book, The Lucifer Principle. And by 1987 and 1988, I was really anxious to get out of popular culture because I had learned everything that I had wanted to learn. I was running out of new things to learn, and I wanted to get back to my science full time. And that I couldn't figure out a way to do it. And then, whammo, I was hit with this really, really monstrous disease. It's called chronic fatigue syndrome. That trivializes it. But for 5 years, I was too weak to talk. I don't just mean that I couldn't hold a conversation. I mean that I could not say a single syllable.
Well, having just had you on the air for 32 minutes, that is hard to believe. Go ahead.
and I couldn't even have another person in the room with me. When my parents drove down from Buffalo, New York to New York City, which is where I live, they had to stay over in the furthest corner of the room. They were only allowed to stay there for 10 minutes. They weren't allowed to say a word, and then they were hauled out of the room again. So for the last years of my parents' life, I never even got to talk to them. which is horrid. It was a monstrous disease. I lost everything that I thought made me human. But it was, it chopped off my ability to do anything that I'd ever imagined doing in my life, with the exception of one thing.
Reading?
No, writing.
Ah.
Writing. Now, some days I was too weak to lift the keyboard. I learned, it took me a long time to learn. I could not try to sit up. That was beyond my abilities. And eventually I had two computers. In those days, computers were not as powerful as they are today. Set up next to the bed, and set up so I could operate them off of one keyboard and one monitor. And then I started writing, and I started writing like a madman. And I started, also, there was this new thing called the Internet. Remember, this is 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And I started going out on the Internet and developed, I had to build a whole new identity in this new medium. And I did. I founded two international scientific groups and wrote three books. But it, in a sense, it was a, we'll use a peculiar word here, a godsend.
Mm-hmm.
But in a sense, it was a godsend, because it forced me to do what I wanted to do anyway, go full time back into my science.
Okay, let me just ask one quick question. How did you come out of that?
I don't know. I mean, my doctor was very wise. He used the Internet, something that's still not done commonly today. And he gave me, in addition to coming out to my home and doing a house visit, which doctors don't do anymore, but was a necessity in my case, he gave me the name of another one of his patients in Texas. He gave me her email address. The two of us went out online. We went hunting for every single treatment modality we could possibly find. And some of those treatment modalities worked. They took years to work, but a combination of things from Big Pharma. I owe my life to Big Pharma. A bunch of combination of things from the big pharmaceutical industry eventually got me out of bed, but it took a long, long, long time, 15 years.
Oh, my God. Okay, we've got about 23 minutes left. Let's talk about the God problem.
Okay.
Now, in it, as you and I spoke off the air, I was looking for, when's he going to answer the question? You don't exactly answer the question. Basically, it's about, I think, more raising questions, opening, as I said, I think at one point, it does not lead to an endpoint. It widens to a vista. So tell us how this book happened and what you hope to accomplish with this book, what your goal, if successful, is with this book.
Okay, well, first, Terrence called me when he was on Highway 450.
405.
Yeah, for 405, and he was about to enter into impossible traffic, and he asked, well, what's the conclusion you came to? What's the answer? And I forgot to tell you this. Let's go back to when I was 19 years old. When I was 19 years old, I was off at my freshman year of college for the first time. My parents had sent me 2,500 miles from Buffalo, New York, to Portland, Oregon, because there was a school out there called Reed College.
Mm-hmm.
And the year that I went there, Reed College had the highest median SATs of any school in the country, higher than Harvard, higher than Caltech, higher than MIT. And so I put you in this book in my position. There you are. It's your first day of math class at Reed College. You're sitting around a big conference table with 11 other students. You have no idea of what is coming. None. You know how remember how confused you get on your opening days of class in each semester? Well, it's one of those confusing days. And suddenly you smell your teacher coming before you can hear her. Why? Because she is using an ancient replication technique, Xerox technique, called mimeograph.
Mm-hmm.
Mimeograph chemicals have this sweet, almost addictive smell.
Yep.
So you smell these chemicals coming down the corridor. She walks in with a small sheaf of paper. She hands them to the student on her right, asks him to pass them around. You get your copy. You take one look. It's only a half a page of paper. It's only half a page of paper. It's 165 bloody words. Now, admittedly, you can't understand a single word, but it's 165 words. And for the rest of the year, every single week, you have to take that 165 words, which, by the way, is five simple, not-so-simple rules called Peano's postulates, Peano's axioms. And from this set of axioms, of simple rules, you have to derive another mathematical corollary. Well, by the end of the year, you have derived the entire natural number system, the entire system of multiplication, division, subtraction, negative numbers, positive numbers, the whole system of math that it took you 8 years of grammar school to learn, 17 pounds worth of grammar school textbooks worth of material, was hidden somehow in those 165 words. And you eventually come up with a theory, and you call it corollary generator theory. And the theory is this: supposing the universe is like a student at Reed College doing her homework. Supposing the universe starts out with four or five simple rules and then extracts the implications, homework assignment by homework assignment by homework assignment, from those rules. Could that be the way the cosmos creates? So that's a big question with which the God problem begins. And the God problem actually ends with something that you haven't seen yet, and that is a new theory of the beginning, middle, and end of the universe. And it's a theory of the beginning, middle, and end of the universe that explains one of the biggest mysteries of our time, and it's called dark energy. It explains why, once they get past a certain point, the galaxies don't just continue expanding away from each other, which they do because we have an expanding universe, that's been known since the 1920s, but begin to accelerate as if somebody were putting his foot down on the gas pedal of a Porsche. They begin to move away from each other faster and faster. And for acceleration, acceleration takes energy. The question is, where does the energy come from? Nobody knows, so we call that energy dark energy these days. Well, this theory, it's called the Big Bagel Theory, explains where that energy comes from. So those are two missing elements from our conversation, corollary generator theory and the Big Bagel Theory of the universe, that I forgot while we were talking while right. You were in the middle of traffic.
Right, right. But one of the things that is very clear is that you go back in the God problem to those two rules of science that you encountered first at the age, I believe, of 10, and standing kind of with those as your stake in the ground is where you sort of begin this search. And what you find is that a lot of what has been absolutely accepted and repeated for centuries, for instance, I just noticed that what you did to explain your answer to the last question was you said it's like being a student at Reed, and the way the universe generates is like a student at Reed generating from these few axioms all of mathematics. Well, that is a metaphor.
Absolutely.
And yet, as you have pointed out, scientists have said since the time of Aristotle that a metaphor is not science.
Well, here's a little mystery. So there I am with Peano's Up Postulates.
And by it's P-E-A-N-O, right?
Yes,
so people can look it up.
And I want to explain this 165 magical words to you, Peano's Axioms, Peano's Postulates. And to do it, well, first I realize there's no way I'm ever going to be able to explain these things to you. They're just as incomprehensible now as they were back when you were 19 years old. Yes, I was one of the few. There were only 1 out of 10 of us who could do the homework assignment. And again, I put you in my shoes, so you're 1 of the 10 who can do them, which means that you get a lot of attention from the girls in class because they need help with their homework desperately. But aside from that, so it's the first time in your life that girls are paying any attention to you. But the fact is, if I can't explain these 165 words to you, how am I going to tell you the meat of the matter in the book? Well, I figure, oh, it's easy. I'll simply tell you the story of what an axiom is. Well, hunting for what an axiom is in the history of science and math turns out to be one of the most amazing experiences of your life, because it turns out that everything that you thought you knew was wrong. Not just everything that you thought you knew, everything that Bertrand Russell wrote in his History of Philosophy, everything that the Encyclopedia Britannica writes, everything that even Wikipedia writes, it all turns out to be wrong. And one of the things that you learn is that if you go through a book called The Posterior Analytics by Aristotle, when you get to page 170 to 180, you will encounter a surprise. The entire program of modern science, complete with modern science's prejudices, is laid out in those two pages, including the idea that metaphor is unscientific. We've been accepting this simple prejudice of Aristotle's ever since. But guess what? Even Aristotle uses metaphor. All science uses metaphor. Metaphor is the basis of science. In Aristotle's case, Aristotle says if you break things down to their elements, you can begin to understand them. Why? And then Aristotle makes a huge metaphorical leap. Once upon a time, a guy named Hammurabi, about 1,700 years before Aristotle, he was a ruler in Mesopotamia, decided to take the simple rules with which we humans associate with each other, the rules that keep us from killing each other and getting into disputes that are destructive to society. He took these simple rules and he had them chiseled in stone. And they were called laws. Okay? So laws are things that rule and restrain human life. Aristotle grabbed these things called laws and applied them to elements and said, if you could understand the underlying principles of the elements, in other words, if you could understand their laws, then you could understand everything that you ever needed to understand in science. Well, we have taken that grotesque metaphor, grabbed from Hammurabi, of laws applied to elements, and we have come to regard that as something built into nature itself. Hell, doesn't nature build on elementary laws? No, that's an Aristotelian invention, and it involves a metaphor. Where else do we see metaphor? Well, the big thing in physics is the particle versus the wave description of light, and all of quantum physics uses that wave description of light. But what is a particle? What's an argument about whether wave is a particle or a wave all about? It's an argument over metaphors. The wave is something that we see in a pond when we set off a ripple. It's something that we see in the sea. The particle is, take a spoon, take the smallest little crumb of bread you can find, mash it down until you get one tiny little piece, then mash the tiny little piece. A particle is the smallest part to which you can reduce something. It's simple, two metaphors. And that's the queen of the sciences, physics and theoretical physics, all based on metaphor. So this book says maybe there are certain underlying patterns that appear in the cosmos at level after level after level after level. And we humans manage to find one instance of that underlying pattern and isolate it at a level that we can easily understand. And then it works for us because we're able to find that simple principle at work in lower levels and higher levels. Now, what in the world is this Bloom character talking about? Well, if you flush your toilet, what do you get? You get a spiral pattern. If you start investigating the properties of electrons flowing through a semiconductor, what will you see? You will see that the electrons don't really want to travel in straight lines. They are so seduced by spiral structures that it's ridiculous. And like trout streams, they go off on the side in little whorls, in little tiny spirals. If you look at your fingertip, what will you see? You'll see a spiral. If you look at the cochlea of your ear, what will you see? You'll see a spiral. If you look at the pictures that the Weather Channel uses to show you what's going on in the atmosphere of the Earth, it doesn't matter whether there's a hurricane or not. One way or the other, you will see spirals. If you look at the Great Red Spot on Jupiter, what will you see? Spirals. It's a great big hurricane system, a permanent hurricane system. It's been there 350 years and is sometimes the size of only two Earths and sometimes the size of three. And if you look out at a galaxy, what will you see? Spiral arms, the spiral. Why does that pattern recur at so many different levels of emergence? Well, it's still a mystery. We haven't spent enough time looking into it, but it can explain why metaphor works. Metaphor works because it captures a pattern like the pattern of the spiral at a level like your toilet flush and then generalizes it to higher and lower levels of the cosmos. That's metaphor. That's why metaphor works, because there are underlying patterns that keep repeating themselves, and we didn't need to ask the question, why? And it's time for us to forget about metaphors or Aristotle's silly statement 2,300 years ago. A man who used metaphor saying that metaphor is not science.
Exactly, exactly. That's Howard Bloom. We're talking about some of the ideas in his book, The God Problem. When I interviewed Stuart Kaufman, the evolutionary biologist, who we were talking about his book, Reinventing the Sacred, one of the points that he makes is that we, and I was reminded of as I was reading yours, was that Galileo's statement that everything can be explained by natural law, that everything conforms to natural law, seems to me to be a to hearken back to Aristotle's rules and laws. And what Kaufman says is it's not true. It's accepted. Everyone proceeds as if it's true, but it is not true. That's the kind of thing you're dealing with in this book repeatedly, correct?
Right. And let me give you a different – Stuart Kaufman's brilliant, and I love his work. But let me give you a reason that this natural law business is not true that isn't in Stuart's
book. Okay, great.
But it is in mine. And that is that Aristotle, remember, said that if you break things down to their elements and then find the laws of those elements, you could account for everything.
This is reductionism, right?
Right. It was reductionism. And back in 1835, two reasonably bright men were sitting around in England thinking this through, and they realized it wasn't true, that there was something dramatically wrong with it. One of them was John Stuart Mill. The other one was a guy named George Henry Luce, who would end up being responsible for the scandal of the century. He would end up living with a female novelist out of wedlock, and it would horrify everybody all over England and Europe. Her name would be Marianne Evans, but she would go under the pen name of George Eliot. But that's not what's relevant. What's relevant here is these two guys are talking about this relatively new thing called chemistry. Now, in this relatively new thing called chemistry, about 50 years earlier, one amateur scientist had done some chemical process, and he had come up with a gas. And it was, you could put it in a bell jar, and you could see its elementary properties. Its elementary properties were just like those of every other gas. You could see through it. You could put your hand through it. If you whiffled your hand back and forth, it would produce a slight breeze, a gas, an element. But if you put a mouse into it, the mouse would die. Another guy who was an amateur scientist, he was a minister, J.B. Priestley, I think focused sunlight using a lens onto mercury and produced another gas. And it had all the properties of a gas. You could see through it, you could put your hand through it, you could create a slight breeze by wobbling your hand through it fast. But if you put a mouse into this gas, the mouse got hyperactive. And if you kept him in this bell jar, he would outlive his brothers and sisters. In fact, Priestley even tried this stuff on himself, felt remarkably peppy, and figured that this was going to make his fortune because this would be the great recreational gas of the next 100 years. He'd make a killing off of selling it. Now, these two guys in 1835 in London are sitting around discussing these two gases for the following reason. Following Aristotelian logic, if in fact you understand everything you know by breaking things down to their elements and understanding the laws of those elements, and if simple Aristotelian style logic is right and 1 plus 1 equals 2, then when you put two bell jars, one of this one gas, one of the other gas together, what should you get? A gas plus a gas equals?
I would think usually a gas.
Yes, twice as much gas. And in fact, that turns out to be the case. Now, imagine adding a little bit of heat. What should you get? Well, a gas plus heat equals a heated gas, right?
Sounds good.
So strike your match, which you can do in 1835, they've been invented, and put it into the great big bell jar with the two bell jars worth of gas, and what do you get? A heated gas? No, that's not what you get at all. Understanding the elementary laws that reduce these things to the properties of gases doesn't help you one bit, because what you get is a thing called an explosion.
I was going to say that, yes.
Yeah, an explosion out of two gases? How does that come from adding up the laws of the elements? It doesn't. And you get something even weirder, Terrence. You get something that, yeah, it's like it's a solid like your tabletop. You can feel it when you put your finger to it, but your finger can go through it. And it's sort of transparent like gas. And it gets together in little round things. And if the little round things come rolling off of your laboratory bench onto your pants, they'll soak into your pants and thoroughly embarrass you. So that until they dry off, you won't want to stand up because it'll look like you've done something unseemly in your pants. So this stuff is called a liquid. It's really amazing. It's called water. Now, there's no way in hell that by knowing the properties of the elements to which these things have been broken down, the two gases and the heat, you will be able to predict either the explosion or the liquid. Something really weird is going on here. And these two guys realize it. And one of them says, first of all, let's give this stuff a name. We'll call it heterotrophic causation. That's the smart one in the bunch, John Stuart Mill. Well, you've noticed that heterotrophic causation has become, the term has become wildly successful, and you and I use it at least 20 times a day, right?
Exactly. Well, and the other guy's idea?
And the other guy's idea is called emergence. Well, by the early 20th century, the concept of emergence and emergent properties has become so popular that there are several cults on the dividing line between science and religion, including one run by Bertrand Russell's partner, Alfred North Whitesides, that are huge. So, these two guys are trying to point out in 1835 that the mathematics of the science of their day will not predict the explosion and will not predict the liquid, nor will breaking things down into their elements and coming to understand those elementary laws. Something is seriously missing from their science, they try to point out. Well, it's 177 years later, and the two deficiencies that these two guys were trying to point to are just as glaring today as they were in 1835. 177 years without really coping seriously with the most creative aspect of the cosmos, how it goes from one sort of thing to a sort of thing that is radically, radically different, how it takes giant leaps in form, structure, and seemingly creativity. No wonder we don't understand the creativity of the cosmos. No wonder the God question is still wide, wide open. No wonder the question of how a godless cosmos creates is still wide, wide open. Because until science abandons Aristotelian logic as the only form of logic, until it abandons 1 plus 1 equals 2 as the only form of thinking, until it takes on heterotrophic causation and takes on emergent properties, big time, until it learns how to anticipate those, how to predict those with its math and its so-called laws, until then, the concept or the question of how a godless cosmos creates itself is going to remain one of the biggest challenges ahead of us. But one major step forward in science is not just to come up with new answers, it's to recognize new questions. That's what science failed to do in 1835, 177 years ago. It's time for science to come out of the closet where it's hiding with Aristotle and to look at the world afresh, to follow the first two rules of science, the truth at any price, including the price of your life, and look at things right under your nose as if you have never seen them before. And now science can be ready to take its next big leap by understanding the creativity of that process that makes a liquid and an explosion when you put together hydrogen, oxygen, and a match.
Okay, that's the voice of Howard Bloom. We're just wrapping this up. I do want to point out, listeners, so you get the idea. The book is a book about science. It's a book about religion, but really it's a book about how we look at the world. It's a book about asking questions. It's a book about following those two rules. And if you can gather from this conversation, it is a book full of stories. It is a book full of stories to take you through this journey. I'm going to do one thing, and then we're basically going to wrap it, which is that you point out five heresies, and we haven't mentioned all of them, but this is one of the things this book takes on. Aristotle's idea that A equals A, which is also Ayn Rand's number one rule, A equals A, not true. 1 plus 1 does not equal 2. The second law of thermodynamics, that everything moves to disorder, is not true. This is not a random universe. And information theory is not about information because it leaves out meaning, and meaning is essential to everything that we approach. Howard Bloom, I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much, and keep up the good work.
Terrence, thank you. Have a great afternoon or evening.
Okay. So, The book, again, is The God Problem, How a Godless Cosmos Creates, and the website to learn more is howardbloombooks.com or howardbloom.net. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do both of those things at my website or at iTunes. And my website has two names, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, all one word. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and three or four articles about the issue, you can do that by signing up at my site or by emailing me at T.E. McNally, T.E.M.C.N.A.L.L.Y., T.E. McNally@mac.com. I look forward to being with you again next week. And again, thanks to Howard Bloom.